Welcome to Hallow Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Come along with us on a spiritual journey that starts with ancient Israel's dramatic escape from Egypt by God's dominating the power and deities of Egypt. In this study, we explore Israel's Red Sea crossing, recounted in Exodus 13 through 15. It isn't just a historical event, but a powerful metaphor for our own spiritual transformation. This change is memorialized in the annual week-long biblical celebration of unleavened bread. We unpack how God's grace is way more than just forgiveness. It's about actively seeking His presence. By examining Exodus 33 and 34 together with 1 Corinthians 5 and 10, we reveal how spiritual maturity means letting go of our total control over our salvation and continuously purging the leaven of self-centered behaviors. The Red Sea is a powerful lesson in spiritual baptism. Israel's safe travel through the waters and Egypt's foolhardy pursuit into them shows how heaven breaks us free from our past so we can commit to a new way of living. It's not just about individual growth, but about maintaining community standards and keeping pure the place where heaven dwells within us, the spiritual temple of our hearts and minds.
Last week, Jeff did his spiel regarding Hezekiah and what took place there with the second Passover. And he talked a lot about spiritual maturity. So when it comes to spiritual maturity, he used this life support example, you know, something like spiritual life support, which is kind of funny visual. That was good. But as far as spiritual maturity is concerned, it's really important as human beings, we're trying to follow God, to grow. Understand the idea of growth and moving forward in our lives, in our walk with God, right? If we stay stagnant at one place or one way of life, we'll survive, but we're not growing in God's intent. So it comes this idea, we covered this, we read today regarding Exodus 13 through 15, or that part of 13 through 15, is they obviously went through the Red Sea storyline. That's what's going on. The Red Sea, the Pharaoh and all his men die and such of that nature. They get the Red Sea, they go to the other side of it, they have a three-day journey, and they have this bitter water to deal with after the singing and praising and such, which is fine. In that walk, in that process of going through that journey, what is that visually, what's the visual we're supposed to understand from that? So I'll talk a little about that concept of the visual imagery that we're given in that storyline and how it ties to a spiritual mature person, as well as what Messiah was doing, and how obviously in 1 Corinthians 10 talks about the idea of tempting and how you're walking through your life. Okay. So a little about that. So we're going to start out here with Exodus 13. Obviously we have the Red Sea. This is my rendition. I'm not an artist, so bear with me. Okay. So you had a bunch of people, right? You're on the seashore and there's this big water, right? You got, you know, Pharaoh and his chariots, his big chariot wheel. And, you know, he has like a dude with like a spear going to go kill him, right? That's the idea. And God's going to part the Red Sea. And he does it in two different distinct ways. How he winds up structuring this. God says, hey guys, chill out. So I know you're freaked out. The bad guys are coming. They're going to kill you. But realize they're not going to kill you. But just sit down and don't do anything, which is an important concept to start out with. When we go through a spiritual walk in life, right, we all have to start somewhere. That's pretty obvious. When you're starting somewhere, do you start knowing everything you're going to be doing? Of course not. You have no clue what the future is. You may have an idea of what somebody else has done, their life story, but you don't know what God's put in your life story. They could be anything as far as you know. So when we're at this point of, do I follow God or do I not? You don't know what your future holds. It's a decision you have to make. And God has to essentially make the decision for you. Hey, this is what I'm calling you to go do or not. He says, I'm not going to have you do it. He only calls those he wishes to call and follow him. So these days, the Israelites have to sit there and say, okay, what do? I either go back, you know, surrender, so to speak, or how do I handle this path before me? And God is telling him, don't do anything. Let me do it. There's some merit, actually a lot of merit. Let God make your decisions for you. We have our instinct to drive. We make our own decisions. I want to go to this. I want to go to that. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. That's a normal instinct to do. But realistically, when you're walking with God in a spiritual maturity, you have to let him make some of these decisions. Actually, technically makes all the decisions. We just think we make them. We actually don't make them at all. He makes decisions. He's smarter than we are. But that spiritual maturity, that giving up of that responsibility and the power, the authority to do make decisions, giving up control, correct? The idea of giving is not an easy thing. Do humans equally easily give up control? The absolute is a dead no. We don't. We take control. We take power. We take charge. Blah, blah, blah. All these great things about we're going to empower ourselves. And God's like, no, that's not what I want you to do. Yes, you have the ability to do those things, but self-control in our spiritual walk requires us to not take control, let God take control, which is a hard thing to do. It doesn't matter what age you are or what life experience, it's always hard. So in this instance, these people have to actually literally say, God, I have a very difficult scenario before me. I have either a surrender, which would be death, or surrender, those two options you got, and then or try to stand and fight. And I don't have the tools to fight with. This is bigger than me. And God's saying, you don't do anything. Do nothing. Just let me do it. So the first step that the Jewish people had to deal with is in this difficult scenario, I realized they had other steps. So the 10 plagues, other things they had to do along the way. But this is their first real challenge of I'm looking facing death in my walk. This difficult thing to do. So God's saying, don't do anything. You just stand still, chill out. I'm going to do it. So God does two things. We'll talk about these are really separate because these are separate events. We have description of the cloud, right? With this big cloud, unbaking cloud. I don't know what the cloud looked like, but I should have colors. I don't have colors. So clouds hanging out in front and led them to this spot. And of course, it passes through as Apostle Paul describes and how he visually or imagines what this looks like. He passes through the cloud, hangs out over here, the arrow in this direction, and that's where it moves. And Apostle Paul describes the idea of them being baptized through this cloud. That's the idea of the cloud and going through this baptism. That's their first baptism, so to speak, in this process. And it is this baptism that is their first spiritual baptism. We're not discussing the physical one because there are many types of baptisms. There's spiritual ones, there's repentance ones, and then there's cleansing of trying to move forward in your life ones. They are actually all three different kinds, they're different purposes. I realize that people quickly jump to this one baptism. Well, yes, there is one baptism, but reality is there's multiple aspects of it. It has different purposes depending on which part of your life you're walking in this moment in time. And the reason I bring this up is because a spiritual baptism, that can happen multiple times in your existence. How many times do we screw up? Anyway, okay, God, I need to start over again. This is a spiritual baptism problem. We have to cleanse ourselves through our spiritual issues. And that's a difficult thing to do. And then, of course, we also have our physical ones. Hey, I committed a sin, a serious sin. Okay, wash myself of my past. And even though I may be following God, I may say, hey, I'm a believer, I follow the, but yet I still sin, still transgress, still have struggles. These baptisms, the idea behind them is, well, let's start again. Let's try again, restart, do it again, and work yourself a little further forward. The baptism has one process, one function, one example, I should say, but has multiple aspects that happen in our lives. Everybody has experienced these processes in life. Your setbacks, your shortcomings, as well as your successes and blessings. They all happen. So their first experience of baptism is basically a spiritual one. We have literally the cloud, it has the angel, it says, describes exactly the angels doing this. And God, of course, winds looking down, parts of the cloud, looks down and see what's going on through this cloud, right? So the first baptism they go through is a spiritual baptism, and they had to literally just sit, just stand still. So this is actually, he's the word stand. To stand, don't do anything. This is, you are not in control of this one. And their spiritual walk, as you go through their maturity, they have to sit there and wait. And of course, after this cloud moves, it prevents death, which death and slavery, in this case, Egypt presents death and slavery. So Egypt over here, and in Egypt, their death and slavery, God's separating them from this life, this scenario. The second baptism they go through, of course, is the water itself. God obviously splits the water. Again, I'm not much of an artist, so we'll just make this, make the water go away. Okay. She has colors. Hey, look at that. I'll take a blue one for water. How pretty. Okay. So we have blue water. God kind of splits. Okay. This is a 2D drawing for the 3D example, so forgive me on this one. So I'll put the water, I'll pretend the water kind of goes up way behind them. I'm making a pathway of a wall of water. And so they get to walk through on dry land. This is their second baptism example, okay? So dry land, with little dry land, they go down to the water. And the water is on both sides. Again, a 2D drawing, forgive me. So they go through this and they're walking through. This is their second, what was that? Drawing like a drafter does, kind of, yeah. So this is their second baptism. Now, this baptism, the intent is different than the spiritual one they went through. The spiritual one, which the cloud, separated them from death, because it was the choice of, actually not just death, as well as enslavement, because Pharaoh was upset. His intent was to capture them, bring them back. It wasn't just murder everybody. It was to capture them. So it was actually a re-enslavement of what they were being protected from, as well as many, I'm sure, would die. It's not like it's a bloodless scenario. So in this scenario, that was what God separated with the spiritual baptism from your death and your enslavement that was going to be returned to Egypt. Well, in this one, it's different. So in this one, they obviously reach to the side. So I'll draw them from over here to over here, right? And I erase the guys on this side. So they walk through, they get to their side. Now, this baptism by itself, them walking through, doesn't really do anything. It's just a pathway. It doesn't become a, quote, baptism, and they would get baptism until after Pharaoh's army goes in. This is a different one. So unlike the cloud, which then God, I guess he erases or he moves the cloud. I can't tell you where he moved it to. It doesn't describe. I assume he moved it back to the Israelite side. So he moves the cloud, and this spiritual walk, as these people have matured, they're no longer standing because they had to walk across, right? Now Pharaoh's men, and they all go in. Now this baptism is distinctly different than the one, the cloud. Because the cloud was a separation between enslavement or death and the Israelites, their freedom, their liberty. In this case, it's not that way at all. This case is actually the execution of the death of the people, the oppressing force that was going to oppress or destroy you. In the second baptism they all go through, so this is number two, they go through, in this case, Pharaoh's army dies, right? This is baptism number two. Their spiritual walk has now progressed some. They went from the spiritual baptism that separated them between enslavement and some death, but mostly enslavement, and freedom. And the next one actually deleted or killed off the ability of the gods that he wanted to go by a strange route. It could not return. Killed off the ability to be enslaved. See the difference? That's what's going on here. And the second baptism, which is the course of water, winds up killing the Egyptian army. So at this point, they went through two baptisms in their lives in a very short back-to-back. It was pretty quick, one day roughly between the beginning and the end. So they went through a spiritual one first, a physical one second. This tells us that the spiritual maturity of a person has a few steps, which is not shocking. We understand we have different steps in life. We walk through our progress as we go through our spiritual maturity. There's the separation of what recognizing what I'm walking away from, the spiritual one. So the people recognize they're walking away or trying to get away from enslavement. That was they walked away. That's how they left Egypt, was to get away from enslavement. And that was a decision they had to walk through. Obviously, God does most of the work there, but still, they had to choose to do so because they went to put the blood on the doorposts, make the decision to walk away from that and then leave. But in the second one, they had to make sure they don't return to it, which God is involved in this. So God obviously had him stand still first. I'll separate you, your walk from enslavement. But then second of all, I have to actually, God's going to eliminate your enslavement ability, the ability to return to this. And that's hence their second baptism. This is not their only baptism, these two. There's another one we'll talk about a little bit later. So in this baptism process, this is an example of our spiritual maturity. But now something unique starts happening. So after Pharaoh and his army all dies, right? So they get baptized twice, okay? And there's Red Sea's behind them. Obviously, you have the dead armies and such. They go along their walk. I'm going to change routes because it's a strange route. Egypt's gone. So going along their walk, they did all these. They had to walk for 3 days. So 1, 2, 3. And they end up at bitter water. So there's a new location. Now, I couldn't tell you precisely what day of unleavened bread this was. My argument, my personal opinion, is probably the last day of unleavened bread because they're traveling like crazy. They're traveling out of Egypt. They have 3 days journey and then they stop. So you have a 3 days journey and you got a pool of water here, which is bitter. You can't drink it. It's poisonous. And at this point, God says, this is their first test of their walk. God's actually talking to them in this storyline and discusses the nature of what his test is and points out, Exodus 15 and the tail end of the chapter 15. So Moses brought the Israel of the Red Sea. They went out to the wilderness to Shur, 3 day journey. Now, mind you, Moses and Aaron had been tasking Pharaoh. They wanted to go a 3 days journey outside of Egypt. This is the 3 day journey we're talking about, not the one through the before Egypt dies. That's all within Egypt's territory. They all owned that property, that land. As they cross the Red Sea into the land of Midian, Egypt no longer owns a territory. They did a 3 days journey into the land of Midian. These 3 days journey, they're traveling into the wilderness, and they found no water. When they came to Marah, the bitter water, they couldn't drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. They were the name of it, Saul Marah. They murmured against Moses, "What should we drink?" He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. He cast it in it. The waters were made sweet. Then he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and they were tested. And then said, this is the important lesson here. If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all the statutes, I'll put none of the diseases on you, which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. So that is the lesson God wanted them to learn from this stopping place. All right. What is the lesson? Diligently heed the Lord your God and what he has to do, the statutes, his commandments, and of course his statutes. So in this spiritual walk, these people are walking. After they went through their spiritual baptism, they went through their physical baptism, and now is saying, now if you want me, God, to be your God and you be my people, you have to diligently, meaning work at it, listen to my commandments, my statutes, and obey them. How easy is that? And it's not. It takes work. Okay. So in this 3 days journey, if you want to live and be with God, you have a job to do. You have to listen to his commandments as well as the statutes. So what he rules, his instructions. That is your spiritual job, so to speak. Okay. Now, I wanted to bring this up because in our New Testament discussion, we'll get to there shortly. It discusses the ideas being portrayed or being given by the Apostle Paul about the examples of these people and what they wound up doing in the wilderness, right? He gave examples of, which we'll read in a little while, about the idolaters, the getting up and playing, and the various, testing God and testing their walk and such. He gives an example, and he's pointing out, Paul's point, you guys are supposed to not do that. That is not, those examples are not the kind of walk that God is looking for, right? To testing him or trying him. That's not what he's looking for. So he was diligently listening to the commandments and the statutes. That's what God's looking for. That's what his objective is. So I have a question for you. This is actually which we did not read in today's section, but it is part of today's Torah portion, Exodus 33. And it talks about an interesting scenario or conversation takes place between God and Moses. All right. Let's go to Exodus 33, because it's part of this spiritual walk and command statutes, what that looks like. And also Paul talks about this a lot in his writings regarding this nature of unleavened bread and the Shabbat and the last days during this. So Exodus 33 is where I jump to in order to get this aspect of this conversation, which is an important conversation to understand. It's not necessarily all what it looks like, if I use a term loosely. So we jump to Exodus 33 real quick, because it's also part of today's discussion. And jumping into verse 12, and we read out of this book. So Exodus 33, verse 12, which it's a section here. It's a conversation that happens between God and Moses. It says, Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and I have also found grace, and you have also found grace in my sight. Therefore, I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people. So God said to him, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. He said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. For how then will be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separated, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. The Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. I'm going to pause there because there's more I want to read about this subject matter. So first of all, Moses brings up this idea that God actually introduces to him as well, this idea of grace. What is grace? It's favor. It's favor. That's what it is. So Moses has God's grace given to him, God's favor given to him. Now, we, as professing believers in Messiah, believe or follow this, we call the rules or instructions of grace, right? We have grace. We have favor. Well, what does that mean? Now, this is an interesting concept I want to bring up to you because it's really important in a spiritual mature walk to understand these concepts. So in these people, their walk was to get to understanding God says, you have to follow my commandments and statutes diligently, and I will heal you and take care of you. Well, in this question, we're going to read more in Exodus 33. We'll get to it in a few minutes. In this walk, it's not just about baptism. That was what you went through to get here. But now there's a responsibility upon us as human beings to retain or stay within that dwelling of God. Now, in Moses' case, God points out, so Moses, you have my grace. You have found grace in my sight. So I get as a result that Moses has God's favor. Now, we ourselves claim we follow God and we follow Jesus and we're in grace. And that's a pretty common Christian concept. But it actually is a Jewish philosophy, not a Christian philosophy. Judaism created it. The idea that God would give favor to somebody. I say created. God created, but it was written in Hebrew scriptures. This idea that God would give grace to someone or favor to someone that he chose. And now this is a question that I have for all of you. Your own thought process. You don't have to answer, but just think about it. If I have grace, if you have grace, what does that gain you? If God's grace is on you, what do you get out of it? It's an important thing to ask. We think, oh, we have forgiveness. No, it's not about forgiveness. That's a classification of mercy. What does God's favor give to you? What is it? What is his favor? Moses actually helps explain what this spiritual walk and this favor looks like and how to correctly use it. He also gives, by the inverse, how to incorrectly use it. Make sense? So Moses gives an example in this section about this walk, this spiritual walk that people went through, this baptism went through in this commandments and statutes. He gives an example of what God's grace looks like, how to use it, and most importantly, God explains how to keep it. You ever thought about that? You have God's favor. Can you drop out of God's favor? Absolutely. You can easily drop out of his favor. You can drop out of his grace. And he describes in our Torah what that looks like and how to retain the grace God has given you as a gift versus how you can lose it. All right? That's an important idea to understand. This idea to dwell with God is responsible. So in the case of Moses, which we can read a little about this as we go along, Moses says, okay, if I've got grace, Moses translates that to, if I have your grace, then I want your presence. You be with us. You lead us. You direct us. Don't deviate. Don't send somebody else. The grace I'm looking for, Moses is saying, is the presence of God. So grace to Moses means God's presence. I think I misspelled the word presence. This is the gift word. How do you spell the word that is it C E and S? Okay. I always get those words mixed up. Is it S C E? I think. Okay, I'm terrible at spelling. Forgive me. It's God hanging out with you, his dwelling place. If I misspelled it, forgive me, okay? So God's presence. Moses translates God's grace, the grace. Well, I'm going to cash this grace in exchange for God's presence, to be with me, to hang out with him. And of course, because I want to see you, and we go through this conversation. And this type of cashing in or exchanging God's grace, if I use the term cash in, for money, so to speak, as you're cashing in, while we exchange for presence, this type of deal, God says, okay, yeah, I will sell you, so loosely, sell you my presence because the grace that I've given to you that you have to buy it with, so to speak. It's kind of, I'm using the term, a monetary concept, but that's the idea. And I want to bring this out to you because unlike the alternative version of grace, which is sometimes used in like a straw man argument, which most people don't really believe this, but they can sometimes treat it this way in their life. And some people will sometimes use grace instead of hanging out in God's presence. They use grace in the form of forgiveness, which is not really its primary focus. We say, well, I have God's grace, then God forgive me. That kind of idea, which is not wrong, but it's not the example Moses is giving us. The example Moses gives is not about forgiveness. Oh, he does bring that up. He does bring that up in this process, which we'll read a bit about that. So let's read about that in 33 of Exodus. Moses does bring up forgiveness because it's not exclusive, it's not not separate completely from grace, but it's the nature of your spiritual walk of how you're using it. So then it says, verse 18 of Exodus 33. It says, please show me your glory. This is Moses talking. And then he said, I will make my goodness pass before you, and I'll proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion, which is mercy, on whom I will have compassion or mercy. And he said, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. And the Lord said, here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock. So it shall be, when my glory passes by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you in my hand while I pass by. I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back. My face shall not be seen. And 34, as we go through this process, we're going to learn about how Moses describes this, or how Moses utilizes this gift. 34 says, chapter 34, verse 1, and Moses said to Moses, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. I will write on these tablets the words were on the first tablets which you broke. So be ready in the morning. Come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain. And no man shall come up with you. Let no man be seen throughout all the mountain. Let neither flocks nor herds feed before that mountain. So he cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. And Moses rose early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him. He took in his hand the two tablets of stone. Now pause here for just a minute. This is a highlight difference. This second time Moses goes up, Joshua does not go with him. The first time, Joshua went with him. Second time, Joshua does not. Verse 5. Then the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, the children's children, the third and fourth generation. So Moses made haste and bowed his head before the ground and worshiped. Then Moses said, if now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go among us, even though we are a stiff-necked people, pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. Now this is Moses playing his cards very well. So Moses asked that God be with him. This is prior to the moment of God revealing his backside to Moses. He says, I want to see your presence, see your nature. And God says, okay, sure. I'll cover your eyes. We can see the backside. That's how it is. And then the words that were spoken out by God as he describes who kind of person he is, Moses says, all right, hold it. Bells go off. You know, alarm bells in Moses' mind. I can use this. All right, God. You're all these things. You've shown me grace, and you gave me your presence. Now, with my next purchase of grace, if I still have it, I want forgiveness for your people as well. So Moses makes essentially two purchases. I want the forgiveness. I got your presence first. I got that. Now I'm making my second purchase with the grace, the still grace that I still have. I want forgiveness for everybody. So grace is not just forgiveness. It can be used for that, but it's not its only function. Notice Moses, though he had previously asked for forgiveness to people, and God was said, hey, I'm going to punish who sinned against me. I'm not going to just forgive these people. That was not the right scenario. God was not willing to give the forgiveness the first time with the whole golden calf thing, at least not the same way that Moses wanted. And so in this time, God says, okay, I can't be with you. You guys are too disgusting. God says, hey, Moses, wait a minute. Yeah, I get we're disgusting, but we're trying. So be with us. Make us distinction. But God, Moses used God's grace to focus on the idea of God's presence, being with Moses, being able to see him. And then he used the forgiveness aspect as well. And he said, go with your people. So this be your people, or nation, use the word nation. The idea that your presence is not just the forgiveness, but also that you will be with your people. So the presence, your presence of with Moses will also be translated to your presence with the people. So the case of God's grace that Moses had, Moses uses it in two different ways, but they actually have the same overall objective. The overall objective is God's presence. That's the overall objective. That's the goal Moses is shooting for. The idea of forgiveness is part of it, but it's not the core drive Moses has. It's that God is with us and we are with God. So when we look at grace, our spiritual walk, and the idea of a spiritual journey going through our baptisms and our separations between our past and what we wish to be, the separation from enslavement versus freedom, the idea behind this whole process is that we want to be with God. That's the point. Because we're all going to die, right? We all die. What happens after we die? That's our objective. Because we can't prevent the death. You can try all you want. You don't have to prevent your death. It's not going to happen. So we have to deal with that at some point, whether it's earlier or late. And if God says, hey, my objective for you people who just crossed the Red Sea is to diligently seek my commandments and statutes and follow them, then I'll be with you. And then God, Moses said, well, if I have God's grace, my favor, I want to be in God's presence. And now if I have your favor, I want to extend that presence to the people. So the people will be in God's presence. It's all folks about being hanging out with God. Does it make sense so far? I didn't lose anybody yet, did I? Hope not. So because we're going to move forward in our spiritual mature walk, this is a process. So now we have not just the simple baptism process, the simple first start, your first few steps. Now we have an objective, target goal, which is God's presence. Does that make sense so far? Then we have to figure out how we're going to get there. So in this, in the part that was read in Corinthians, we can't go there just yet. Sorry, we can't jump to that because there's a precursor to that section. We're going to read through this a little bit in Exodus still. There's a certain, right. So this is an important concept. Now this concept I want to bring up to you is that in Moses' request, in this idea of in his people's, God's presence amongst God's people, this is not, Moses was not asking for God's presence in each individual human being. Notice he said in your nation, your people, this group as a whole, not as individuals. Not that you can't be in God's presence as individuals. That wasn't Moses' request. And I'm bringing this up because this is going to go through a list of 34 that God gives. Regarding if you want me, God, to be in the presence of this people as a nation, I have requirements which are different than the Ten Commandments, which that's shocking, right? We have the Ten Commandments, right? That's what God wants of us. No, that's not just what God wants of us. There's Ten Commandments that's important as individuals as well as people. But in this case, God says, okay, if you want my grace, my presence to be with the people, I can give it to them because God will give it to them. But now they have to keep it. That's the harder part. So in 34, we get to see God because Paul talks about this, gives examples of what this looks like and what it doesn't look like. That's what we'll talk about in 1 Corinthians 10, as well as in 5. He talks about these examples. So this is what our problems, our struggles with God's grace, actually how we can misuse it or incorrectly use it. So in verse 10, it continues on and God starts giving a laundry list or a sequence list of what he's expecting as he goes through this. So behold, this is God speaking. Behold, I make a covenant before your people. I will do marvels such as not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation, on all the people among whom you are, shall see the work of the Lord. For it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. I am driving out before you the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you're going, these would be a snare in your midst. But you shall utterly destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other god, Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous god. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifices to their gods, and one of them invites you and you to eat of his sacrifice, and you take of his daughters for your sons, your daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. So you shall make no molten gods for yourself. So in this first section list, God says, okay, Moses, you want my presence with these people as a nation, as a whole. I'm going to require some things from them. This part is not different from the Ten Commandments. Actually, technically, none of this is, but it's just there's some subtle variations we don't usually look at. So I erase this really quick to make example of what we're discussing here. I'm going to erase my 1, 2, 3 days here, my 3 days journey. So these commandments and statutes, we have God groups as far as if you want this, my presence, these people, I'm going to require something of you. You have no covenant with these people, with wicked. So no covenant with wicked people. That's your fundamental process. As well as destroy idolaters, the idols, destroy, it's an R, right? Idols. And of course, was an example, don't worship the gods. So no worship. These are not very different at all from the Ten Commandments. There's only, one God. You only worship one God. It's pretty straightforward. What I want to bring up to you, however, is that we sometimes can, as the Apostle Paul points out, which was just read today in 1 Corinthians 10, sometimes can look at destroying idols or not worshiping idols and misunderstand what that means, the example that looks like. Because Paul used the example of them getting up to play, right? This enjoyment or pleasure seeking as opposed to God seeking, right? That is still an idol worship, in case the idol yourself is the actual pleasure. You have an idol of pleasure. It's possible to do. So there's different forms of idol worship, but these are the examples God says starts out, okay, if you want me to be my presence, this is your first requirement. You must maintain this through your life or through this process. And of course, he gives examples, daughters and worshiping and playing harlots and such, as far as in with their gods, all part of the God worshiping of the God, or of the gods. And his next item on his list, a God's list, if you want my God's presence with the people, the feast, the verse 18, the feast of unleavened bread you shall keep. 7 days you eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you in the appointed time in the month of Aviv. From the month of Aviv, you shall come out of Egypt. Let's pause there for a minute. So now his next list he has is on his, I'm making more room on my whiteboard here. Hold on. I'm going to erase. I should have moved some of this stuff. I'll erase this part here. I need a better eraser. Change holders here. So in this next list says you have unleavened bread. So we have these items. Don't make covenant with the wicked people. Destroy their idols. Don't worship their gods. And next, unleavened bread. So unleavened bread, that's this part of God's requirement. If you want my grace and keep it, is maintain this. That's an interesting requirement. Do we normally think of that? We think of the Ten Commandments. That usually isn't. Unleavened bread is not the top thing. Think, oh, God's commandments, the Shabbat, don't kill, don't murder. Actually, in fact, in this list, doesn't have the not killing and not murdering. So that's weird. Why is that important? Because it's not that it's important. That we're talking about God's grace here. We're not discussing right and wrong. We're talking about retaining God's grace as a community. We're not referring to individual people. It's a whole community. So as a community, you're observe unleavened bread for 7 days. And he also has to continue on his list to the next item. He says that verse 19, all of the womb of mine are of a male, the first thing among your livestock, whether ox or sheep. First thing of a donkey, however, you shall redeem with a lamb. If you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. All the firstborn of your sons should redeem, and none shall appear before me empty handed. So his next list requirement for God's grace to be retained is your firstborn. They all belong to God. And there's a cycle of redeeming, or how you redeem this firstborn peoples or firstborn people here. Again, when we think of the Ten Commandments and God's walk with us as individuals, this is not usually the top list, right? It's usually on the list at all. We don't think about the fact that God is saying the first belong to me, but we're not talking about Ten Commandments. We're talking about God's list to retaining his grace. He gives it. But retaining it is what we're talking about. Not necessarily the gift of it, it's the retention of it. Once you give it, what do you do with it? How do you utilize it? And continue on in, And then he lists verse 21. 6 days shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, and plowing time and harvest time shall rest. So this makes sense. Oh yeah, fourth commandment, yeah, Shabbat, totally makes sense. So we have God say, you will observe Shabbat. Nothing strange about that. That's part of the Ten Commandments. So as a community, as a people group, Shabbat matters to retain God's grace within the community. Then, of course, he lists off in verse 23, you shall observe the Feast of Weeks, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end. So again, Feast of Weeks, which we're in right now, is the Feast of Weeks, the cycle of the counting of the weeks, the Omer. So we have the Omer, and because that leads to the wheat harvest, is Shavuot. I misspelled that one. And of course, he has the end gathering, the we call it Sukkot, is an example. Sukkot is more than just Sukkot. It obviously includes, you have trumpets, you've got atonement. There's more than just Sukkot alone. But Sukkot itself is usually grouped as the end gathering. It's the biggest harvest that takes place. So these are the things that God is listing so far. He's not done yet, though. You have to retain God's grace. Verse 23. Three times a year, all your men shall be before the Lord your God of Israel. So it requires a pilgrimage. So not just observing these things, but you're going to be an active participant in them. So the pilgrimage, he requires, pilgrimage as far as how you're traveling to the feasts of wherever God puts, is all retaining God's grace. And then, of course, he points out in this traveling, verse 24, he reassures them, I'll cast the nations before you and enlarge your borders. Neither any man covet your land, but you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, nor shall the sacrifice of the feast of Passover be left until morning. So now there's another requirement. So not only is it unleavened bread, he goes back to the concept of unleavened bread, is that Passover, you must have no leaven. So it's unleavened, which is, well, that's obvious, right? Because why would we put leavened bread in Passover anyway? It's part of the whole point. Right, but he makes point, hey, when you observe Passover, that's one of the requirements. Make sure you don't deviate from that. And of course, he also says, don't leave it up till morning. So it has to be consumed that particular day, which is part of the Passover regulations. There's no deviation there. And he points out also to retain this covenant grace period that Moses is asking for. Verse 25, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice. Verse 26. And the first fruits of your land, which you shall bring the house of the Lord your God, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Those are his last two requirements. So we have first fruits, roots, and then we have the kid in milk. I'm not going to pretend I know what all that is supposed to mean. I just said that's what his list is. It lists out. So to retain the grace Moses is asking for the people as a whole, here's God's list. This list does not look like Ten Commandments. Well, it has some parts of it, but does not look like Ten Commandments at all. There's a lot of stuff that I would never put on Ten Commandments. Is a pilgrimage feast the Ten Commandments? No, not even close. The count of the Omer, is that part of Ten Commandments? No, we're in it right now. We're in the middle of that. We're at day six, right? But that's not. Why would I think that? The Ten Commandments. We're not discussing as individuals. Moses asks as a community, as a whole, the people group, the nation, to retain God's presence, his grace. This is what he's going to require of the nation to do. Note, stealing is not listed. You know, thou shalt not steal, right? Murder is not listed. Thou shalt not murder, not listed as a nation, which is interesting. We wouldn't think about that. Honor your father and mother, not listed. Right? Coveting, not listed. So a lot of things the Ten Commandments listed, the God said, as a nation, those are not his priorities. If you want God's presence to retain or stay with you as a nation, these are his priorities to retain that grace. And that's what I bring into the Apostle Paul's conversation, because he discusses this a lot. Because in the case of spiritual maturity as a nation, he's expecting the nation to mature to at least this level. And then it will retain God's grace. Yes, we don't murder, we don't steal, we don't commit adultery. That's not part of this list. God's referring to the nation. Why? Because individuals of the nation may do those bad things, won't they? I mean, reality is individuals do a lot of bad things. But as a nation, he's looking for, you want my grace as a nation, my presence as a nation, this is what I require of you. Which is interesting. We don't usually think about these things. At least I don't know about you, but I don't usually think about these things. These are maybe just a one-off or one person's, you know, route. But for me, I don't think about it. Now let's jump to Apostle Paul's conversation about this topic. So we read a part of 1 Corinthians 10, which we're going to go back to shortly. But there's two places he discusses this idea. But 10 is the first place we'll go, and we probably should go to 10 first. Yeah, let's do 10 first. So first, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10, which was read earlier. We'll jump to 1 Corinthians 5 shortly, because it also ties into the exact same topic being covered, because Apostle Paul talks about these topics, spiritual walks. So in the case of 1 Corinthians 10, he discussed about this tempting God or tempting Messiah in this case. Is that I don't want you to be? What was that? Can you guys hear me? I'm hearing some feedback, but I'm not sure what. You're not okay. In 1 Corinthians 10, it pointed out that, moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed the sea. Well, we talked about that earlier, right? All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They had the same spiritual food, all ate the same spiritual drink. They drank the spiritual rock that followed them, and that the rock of course was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So, pause there for a minute. So, Apostle Paul is pointing out that the people themselves, God explained on the third day in Marah at the bitter waters, commandments, diligently heed and follow God's commandments, his statutes. And they did not. They chose not to. So, in this lack of diligence, is that going to lead them toward God's presence? Are they going to receive the presence of God? The answer would be no, they won't. Hence, he was not well pleased. Now, these things became our example, verse 6, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now become idolaters as some of them, as is written, that people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now let's commit immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them, as some also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, except as is common to man. But God is faithful, will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. With the temptation will also make a way of escape that you're able to bear it. So in this example, also Paul's example pointing out that the people who were, God was telling this stuff to, explaining these things to Moses and Israelites, if you want my presence, you want my grace to be with you, I require some things of you. But were any of these lists that God gave, were any of these the primary struggles that they have written up here? These were not the primary struggles of the people, were they? Unleavened bread was not their primary struggle, was it? Idols? That definitely was. The no other gods was their primary struggle. They had other issues, sexual pleasures, which is idolatry. Those of you not familiar with the idea of idolatry, we can think of an idol as an idol thing you bow down to. But seeking your self-pleasure, or what you desire in your pleasure in life, seeking pleasure, not for seeking happiness, for seeking pleasure, that is also idol worship as well. It's your idol is the pleasure itself. That categorizes, of course, drug addicts, alcoholics, sexual perverted individuals, anybody who just seeks their own personal self-pleasure over what is right, right? It could be obviously personal gain like money and such too, but usually those aren't the self-pleasure categories. Those are just acquisition of property and power. So idol worship was their primary weakness in the case of the people that came out of Egypt. These other items that God lists, if you want to retain God's grace, these were not even on their radar. This was not their primary interest, but that was God's interest. God wants this interest. You want diligent follow God as commanded statutes, then these matter to him. As a nation, not for individuals, as a nation, they matter to him. Individuals have to take commandments for that. So in this case, we have that this is for our purpose, as Paul explained, we could see that idols is a big problem for human beings in our spiritual walk, our spiritual maturity. We have to destroy or get rid of these idol problems, these idols that we have as human beings. But for God's grace to abound as a nation, we as a nation have more responsibilities than just idols, right? Idols are important, but there's more to it than just idols. Other aspects of this storyline that we're supposed to be paying attention to. And I'm not going to pretend to understand the kid in the milk thing. I don't. I don't understand it all. I don't understand what God was thinking. I'm not that smart, but God is. So it's okay. I'll just accept what it is. But all these processes are as the God's grace. If you want God's grace as a nation, that's what requires of a nation. Did the nation of Israel do this? No. Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, attempted to return some of this to his nation, right? As Jeff pointed out last week, he obviously instituted the Passover. It was a month late. They said he did, but I forgot the details. The second month of it happening. So he's reinstituting the Passover cycle, and unleavened bread cycle. He's trying to drive the nation back into God's favor or God's grace. They're synonymous. So driving back in that direction because they did not diligently follow the commandments or statutes of God. And they, as a nation, were not observing this. Hezekiah was not focused on the lack of murder or the lack of stealing. That was not his primary drive. It was observing God's instructions of how a nation needs to be in God's presence and God's favor, which is obviously a very different list, okay? So let's jump to 1 Corinthians 5, because I like this passage explaining on both an individual level as well as a community level, because reality is I, Daniel Agee, have zip power or influence over the nation that I live in. Nothing. They couldn't care less if I lived or died. That's it. So I can't make or instruct or teach my nation to do dilly squat. Okay. They're not going to listen. It doesn't matter what, maybe some of you do have that power. I don't. So I don't have that authority. But I do have some control or some influence, I should say, is more accurate within the community that I serve, which is in this case, which Paul's discussing, a religious community, a church or a group, a fellowship, a congregation, or a family. It's all the same. It's all categorized the same. Things that we do have control over, some influence over. So 1 Corinthians 5, now this is a specific example given that is about the leavening and unleavened bread that Apostle Paul is trying to point out. Because unleavened bread for 7 days, that's fine, whatever, no big deal. That's easy to do. We just scrap out yeast. So we get by crackers for a week. Not a big deal, right? Or make them. But this is more than just unleavened bread. This God is saying in verbal form, unleavened bread for 7 days. But there's meaning behind the unleavened bread. It's not just eating crackers for a week. So in 1 Corinthians 5, we'll do an example of God that the Apostle Paul gives as a real spiritual example of what unleavened bread means or looks like, okay? So as a nation, as well as not just as individuals. So this is 1 Corinthians 5 says, it actually is reported that there's immorality among you, such as sexual morality that is not even named among the Gentiles, the man that has his father's wife. And, this part's interesting to me, and you are puffed up and not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. For I indeed, as absent in body, but present in spirit, have already judged as though I were present concerning him who has done this deed. In the name of our Lord Jesus, when you are gathered together, along with my spirit, with the power of the Lord Jesus, I deliver such one to Satan, the destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved the day of the Lord Jesus. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a leaven leavens a whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. And since you are truly unleavened, for indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed, therefore let us keep the feast not with leaven of, with old leaven, nor with leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexual immoral of the people of this whole world, or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since then you'd have to indeed go out of the world. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is a fornicator or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. What have I to do with judging those who are outside? Do you not judge those who are the inside? For those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, put away for yourselves that wicked person. So in this instance, this is not the only, one more place that Paul also talks about the same thing shortly. So in this example, Paul's saying, okay, as a community, as a body, in this case, a church or whatever you call it, I don't know what you call it, Corinthian congregation, fellowship, whatever you call it, as a community within your ability, because he's not talking about a nation, right? Paul's talking about a nation, as a community, as a church organization, or as a ecclesia, or as a fellowship, as a group or a synagogue, as a group, with inside your group, you have responsibilities to essentially accomplish this list. Not necessarily that you will succeed at everything, but certain problems. He points out, he used the citation of in this example. He also uses another one, which we'll talk to a little bit, which Jesus cited as well. Given here is a weakness this Corinthian church he's referring to has fallen prey, and that they have puffed themselves up. And how did they puff themselves up? So some dude sleeping with his mother-in-law or stepmother, what do you call it? His stepmother, I presume. What does that mean to me? I'm not doing it. He is. That's his problem, right? Me, not mine, right? Well, actually, there's a couple of ways we can look at this. And I'm not saying which is right. I'll say this, how a couple ways you can look at this. So I'll tell you how Daniel Agee looks at it. I'm going to erase this real quick, this kind of section here. Is that, okay, the whole community of Corinthian church was not participating in sleep with this guy's mother-in-law or stepmother, right? I'm thinking it's stepmother, I presume. I'm hoping it's stepmother. So the whole church wasn't sleeping with his stepmother, right? Just one dude was. But the people that knew about it, they knew clearly it was because obviously Apostle Paul found out wherever he's living at this moment in time for a long way that the story got to him, what was going on. So this was fairly common knowledge. That's where I gather. So in this scenario, we have a body of people, and you have one guy and his stepmother who are sleeping together, all right? They shouldn't be, but they are. Then you have other people who are in the congregation. There's probably some women and men. I don't know all of them. There'd be a difference. There's the people in congregation. A puffed up people. And this story of this particular couple has been well known or been traveled or people have found out about it throughout the territory or region. The only way I personally, Dale Agee, imagine the people themselves being puffed up is that they're pointing out the fact that we accept this person. So it's kind of like, for example, saying, well, we accept, come as you are, all sinners, that type of idea. We forgive everything. We forgive all types of sinners. I don't know if this is true. It's just how I, Daniel Agee, imagine it. The people themselves are proud the fact that they accept this person in their congregation. That's how I view it. Now, you may view it differently. This is how I view it. And they aren't abhorrent. They aren't kicking them out. They aren't angry. They aren't doing anything about it. They're holding accountable, right? Well, in this instance, this is within their community, right? Amongst these examples, Apostle Paul likens this to, well, you're no longer eating unleavened bread anymore. You're no longer observing God's besides Passover, right? You're not participating in this anymore. You're rejecting these components because you have popped yourself up and not allowing or getting rid of this individual does not belong with you. So again, we deal with idolaters and self-pleasure. Is this relationship between this guy and his stepmother, it would classify in my mind a self-pleasure. He wants to or they want to. As opposed to being right. It's not about being right, but wanting to. Well, wanting to is the same category the Israelites did that came out of Egypt. We have this individual who is worshiping his idols. He's an idol worshiper. That's what he classifies on. He is doing in that same category. And that you're allowing an idol worshiper, in this case, illegitimate relationship, and proud of it and not telling the idol worshiper, this person in this scenario, get out. You don't belong here. It's a hard thing to do, but as a community, it's a job. Imagine for a minute what doesn't happen if you didn't do that, or what happens when you didn't do that. Let's say they stayed. Well, there are kids growing up in this congregation too, right? Little kids, right? And there are other people in the congregation who are newly showed up. Oh, who's this? Well, who this? What are they learning by this relationship? Really acceptable behavior, aren't they? And is it acceptable behavior? No, it's not. So by not rejecting, saying this behavior does not belong here, you are inflating and contaminating or spreading a bad behavior, aren't you, in your congregation? So in my imagination, how I view it, I imagine the congregation is not purging out what doesn't belong because it's going to corrupt the whole congregation eventually in various ways. I mean, not every single human being, but a percentage of them will start corrupting themselves in a similar fashion. That's how I view it. You may view it differently. That's how I view it. So in this case, false Paul likened this idol worship scenario under unleavened bread category. So that's how I'm viewing this. So when we covered 1 Corinthians 10 and that nature of being baptized or through the Red Sea as well as into Moses and such, there's a responsibility that goes with it. We do not hang around such behaviors, such types of people, but also we have a responsibility within ourselves to avoid or reject this relationship type category that is corrupted or twisted to individual people. There's more to this. I know I'm over time, so I apologize. There's just one more thing I want to hit on this exact subject matter. The Apostle Paul extends this a little bit in this process. Let's jump to verse. Okay, there's too many verses. I can't cover them all. So I'll just end it a little earlier than that. So in 1 Corinthians 6, he talks about the same subject matter, because Paul talks about this a lot, right? This is a sexual immorality, which is also classified as idol worship, is a problem amongst people. Because unlike I can bow down to a piece of rock, okay, that has eyes cut out to it, a piece of wood that I carved earlier this week, I can bow down if I want to. That's an idol worship. But seeking self-pleasure is also idol worship. It's the same thing. Just because I either have a rock in front of me or I have a girl in front of me, it's still self-pleasure. I'm still bowing down the same thing, right? Just because of what I'm bowing down to doesn't change. It's still what I'm doing. So in Corinthians 6, 1 Corinthians 6, sexual immorality is also a sin against your body. Apostle Paul describes this nature of what this sexual immorality is producing, not just this corruption of your community, corrupts your actual human being, the body itself. So even though this God's list for God's grace was given upon a nation as a whole, we have the responsibility that this idol worship scenario is affected by individual human beings participate that. I mean, yes, I realize there's some twisted, wicked, like multi-group things going on, but we're not discussing those. When the individual people do this type of stuff. So when we have idol worship as your body, so your body, this idol worship of self-pleasure, pleasure, this process is a sin, but the way the Apostle Paul describes it, unlike most sins, I can go beat up a guy or go steal from so-and-so or I do, those are all external things I'm doing to somebody else. For the case of sexual misconduct, it's a pleasure and it's classified under the idol worship, idols, that's what it's classified under. With self-pleasure, you're actually abusing your body, which is abuse. And that is an internal problem. It is an internal sin as opposed to an external sin. It describes this, the same with this guy and his wife and this puffed up community. It's that the puffed up, the guy and his wife is an internal sin he's committing with this, his wife, his stepmother. Internal sin he's committing, right? That's what that is. But it's affecting the community as inside the congregation as a whole. So it's abuse, but it's internal abuse. So it's abuse to internal. Oops, that's an N. So it's an internal type of scenario going on as far as this type of sin that is corrupting everybody. That internal sin is an example of what he's saying. This is reprehensible. This is the sins category we have to actually purge out. This is where our self-control comes into play, our spiritual walk. So the whole point of all this journey I wanted to talk to you about was that even though they started out with the cloud and going through the whole baptism spiritually, right? And they started out going through the Red Sea, wash away the past and such. And God says, now I need you to be with me, diligently heed and follow my commandments and instructions. And if you want me to be with you as a nation, I require you to obviously not do idol worship. Don't puff yourself up. You eat unleavened bread. First, we go to God. You observe Shabbat. All these requirements God has for as a nation. The weaknesses that Apostle Paul is addressing his day is this internal sin is a huge problem. That internal sin is abusing of God's temple, God's dwelling place, because Apostle Paul likens, and Jesus does too, likens our bodies as an example of the temple of God. He dwells with us. That's where we get our presence, our grace, God dwelling with our bodies. And internal sin corrupts the dwelling place of God. And sexual immorality is internal sin that corrupts God's dwelling place. Is he going to leave his grace with you if you've corrupted the house he dwells in? As we know, you've lost it. because what you've done by corrupting the house it belongs to, you now have moved on to worshiping idols, seeking self-pleasure, which is synonymous. Okay. So worshiping idols, seeking self-pleasure, you've corrupted the internal sin. Therefore, God's grace, which he said, I require these things of you, the including Shabbat and Sukkot, but also the idol worship required to not do that, to receive and to retain, my grace, I require that. If you go into sin of internal sexual morality, you've puffed yourself up, your community up for various reasons, but you have now abandoned God's grace that he gave to you as a gift. The point of this, that our spiritual mature walk, we went through days of unleavened bread. The idea is that now we have to start walking through the process of learning God's instructions the next 43 more days, whatever it is. Do the math. Continue to walk through this process of what does God want from me to avoid my internal sins, so to speak, issues. I have those, we have to deal with those internal sins. We're all part of our lives to reduce them. The seeking self-pleasure. These are requirements of not just a community, they are a community, but also my own personal life too. Can I not also obey these as a person? Yes, I can. These lists that God gave are also not just community, but I can also do them as a human being. I can observe unleavened bread as a human being, individual. So it's not just God's grace to community. It's actually also inclusive of God's grace to me too. These are still part of my walk. Yes, I'm not going to murder. We're not discussing murders. We're not discussing stealing or coveting, even though those are part of the Ten Commandments. Retaining God's grace is an important goal or highly corrupted, right? If we propagate, assist, bless, normalize, those twisted behaviors, ignore twisted behavior, right? Ignoring them, as Jeff points out, they would apathy, the idea of not caring. If we normalize or treat those behaviors as being acceptable, what are we doing? We're treating that idol worship is now acceptable with inside of our community, our house, our home, our loved ones, our families, our church. We're treating this being normal. This is totally fine. Well, it's not fine. If you allow abnormal behaviors, classified as idol worship, it may corrupt the individual's internal problem to them as a human being, but it also corrupts your community you belong to. Now, reality is, do someone show up in your church or your house or your relative and advertise their mistakes and their miseries in life? Typically, no. I realize some do. We're not talking about AA meetings. Typically, people don't advertise. But in this case, with the example of the sin-sitting man with his stepmother, that was clearly advertised. That was well known or was brought to their attention. The point being, when we have someone brought their attention, hey, we have this problem, what are we supposed to do about it if we're going to have a spiritually mature walk with God? We have to retain God's grace. So the responsibility is, okay, as Paul pointed out, you cast the leaven out. Cast the lump out. Now, later on, the person repents. That's great. Bring it back in again. The point being, the example which I get from this, is Daniel H's opinion, what I get from it is that a person may be sinning. Because the apostles point out in Acts 15, you don't know the laws of God, right? You just show up, hey, I'm Joe Schmo, nice to meet you. What is this? It's called a synagogue. Oh, what do you guys teach? Laws of Moses? Never heard of the guy. You walk in, the guy, he knows nothing about the laws of Moses. He may have a laundry list of things that Moses would prohibit, couldn't do. God says, don't do those things. But he doesn't know about them. We're not referring to people who are completely ignorant. Because that person learns the idea, they would learn, and they would change their behavior. That's the reason the apostles gave in that concept, because the laws of Moses are taught in the synagogue each week. That was the reasoning. Now imagine that the same person chooses to not change. I'm content with my way of life. I like my 4 girlfriends, 3 wives, and 8 homosexual relationships I have each week. Okay, that's a lot. You're busy. Those examples, like, wait a minute, I'm sorry, dude. You don't belong here. This isn't your community. You don't belong here. Go away. Now they may say, oh, I'm so sorry. I got rid of all of them. I stopped my behavior. I'm now upright, Torah observant, whatever. Okay. Now we can talk. Now we have a community. Now I realize there are liars and cheats and deceiving people all over the place. Those are hard to control. But when we're aware of them, if a person's not willing to address or change, we have to address, what do we do about it? Yes, Lori Ann? Whose responsibility is to help them? That's her question. Lori Ann's question was, whose responsibility is to help the individual change? to learn the laws or learn Moses' way, anybody in a group could tell them. I mean, if you know the laws of Moses or you know the laws of God, any human being can talk about God's laws. He wants all people to still diligently seek his commandments, to heed them in his statutes. Anybody can teach. That doesn't take a lot of work. You say, hey, law says this, laws say that, don't do this, you're supposed to do that. Anybody can do that. Granted, I wouldn't recommend an infant doing that. They wouldn't know much. But any mature spirit, we're talking about sometimes you give somebody a change. I don't know. I don't have the answers for how much time lapsed. There is humility. Yep, she points out. If a person does not acknowledge the problem, are they likely to change? Answer would be no. If I don't acknowledge that there is a problem, I have a problem, then I'm not going to be changing the problem, am I? So no incentive to change. These are spiritually mature walks. We want to increase our spiritual maturity. Goes beyond Jeff's example of the life support, right? You have to go past that. It's going to be, instead of just, okay, God, keep me alive, let me survive. It's not about just survival. It's about actually walking with him. And that is the example, as well as teaching, giving the example, tell people, hey, these are behaviors you don't do. Change the behavior. Don't keep company with these individuals. They're not willing to change the behavior. I can't answer when someone is or isn't willing. I realize there are alcoholics, for example. Or alcoholics for years, or drug addicts, or any other kind of, for years. They don't change that quickly. I don't study alcoholism. I don't study drug addiction. I don't know how difficult it is. I'm not that smart. But those behaviors, if they're not willing to accept, hey, I have a problem, well, there's a problem right there to begin with. So you have to recognize, to read the laws of Moses, what is right, what is not right, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what things can I need to work on or improve. Once a person is not willing to improve, to change, Apostle Paul says, boot them. They can't stick around. They're going to corrupt everybody else. So as a spiritually mature person, it's not an easy walk, but it's a walk that has to be done. So I apologize for taking you guys over time by a long shot. But the unleavened bread is a big deal in the concept of walking through God's walk. And I didn't go through, obviously, Deuteronomy or Kings or Jeremiah or anybody else. Talk about the same topic. Hopefully I didn't lose anybody. Jeff used the example of the spiritual life support. I use the example of pay to play, which is kind of a similar concept of, yeah, I do this and then God gives you that. It's like an exchange. It's a very immature individual. But we're looking for something, our spiritual walk for unleavened bread as we're coming to its end, to move forward and start filling up with what is good and not what is evil, to reject what is evil and destroys us as a community or us as an individual human being, the internal sins. That is a good responsibility, and it's not an easy task, but it's still responsible to be that type of mature walk in our days of unleavened bread and the next 43 more days of counting.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.